His family moved to Long Beach. Woldemariam returned to Palms often, and at one point encountered a new resident in the neighborhood, Snoop Dogg. It's unclear how exactly they knew each other, but their crews were at odds. On August 25, 1993, they confronted each other. Woldemariam had just turned 20. Snoop was 21, and Doggy Style was 3 months away. Woldemariam and two gang friends were on their way to Palms Woodbine Park when he began arguing with a Snoop associate named Sean Abrams in front of Snoop's apartment. They separated, and reports vary about what happened next. Within an hour, Snoop's bodyguard, McKinley Malik Lee, Abrams, and Snoop were headed to a recording studio in the latter's SUV when they confronted Woldemariam's party, now at the park. Snoop was behind the wheel, and Lee was armed. They later claimed they were attempting to resolve the situation when Woldemariam jumped out of the bushes and pulled up his shirt, revealing a .380 automatic handgun. "Either he was going to die or I was going to die," Lee said. He shot Woldemariam, and Snoop peeled out. The Ethiopian immigrant stumbled into an alley before collapsing and died soon after. Woldemariam's defenders contended that Lee was the aggressor, noting as evidence that the victim was shot in the back and the buttocks. Though Lee said they promptly called 911, he and Snoop failed to turn themselves in. Snoop was out on bail for weapons charges. They would eventually be dismissed. And Lee said they weren't going to surrender without Death Row's attorney, David Kenner, who was then out of town. They went on the lam, and Snoop stayed in hiding for a full week, inspiring a dramatic manhunt that brought the LAPD and Sheriff's Department to the 1993 MTV Video Music Awards held at Universal Amphitheater. Detectives were tipped off that Snoop would present an award, and indeed he did, for Best R&B Video, alongside Dre and George Clinton. The cops somehow still couldn't snag him. But following the show, he turned himself in. He and Lee were charged with murder, 187, and Death Row quickly posted his $1 million bail. The criminal case would stretch on for almost 2.5 years, with Woldemariam's family accusing Snoop of using the murder charge against him for commercial gain. At the 1994 MTV Video Music Awards, Snoop capitalized on his legal trouble, performing his new fictionalized song, Murder Was the Case, whose lyrics begin with his character getting shot and falling into a coma. Wheeled on stage in a wheelchair, Snoop was accompanied by a full choir before a giant cross hanging from the ceiling and a prop casket which emitted a spotlight up toward the heavens. "It's going to take a miracle, they say, for me to walk again," he rapped, before springing out of the chair. As the song finished, Snoop proclaimed his innocence, and soon after released a short film of the same name. Again, its plot departs from real-life events, such as the scene where a pair of bumbling ambulance drivers, carting Snoop's dead body and smoking weed, engage in an epic gun battle before crashing the ambulance and exploding. The soundtrack featured Natural Born Killers, Ice Cube and Dr. Dre's first post-NWA collaboration, and went double platinum. But Snoop took little joy. Despite the cocksure posture he displayed in his videos, behind the scenes, he desperately feared that everything he'd worked toward, his very freedom, was in jeopardy. "It was probably the worst 2.5 years of my life," Snoop said. Painted by the prosecution as a ruthless gangbanger, Snoop faced trial in the court of public opinion as well. The mainstream media had been poking nervously at gangster rap for a number of years, but Snoop's charge, alongside his burgeoning popularity, sparked blanket coverage. Wearing a knit cap and looking surly, he appeared on a November 1993 Newsweek cover, alongside the headline, "When is Rap Too Violent?" "You may never have heard of some of these stars, but your kids have," warned Tom Brokaw, introducing a lengthy NBC Nightly News piece on the subject. Mentioned in the same breath as Snoop were Flavor Flav of Public Enemy, charged with attempted murder, and Tupac Shakur, who, with two associates, was alleged to have sexually abused and sodomized a woman in a New York hotel. This was shortly after Tupac was picked up for shooting two off-duty policemen in Atlanta. In early 1994, the U.S. House and Senate held hearings about the effects of hardcore hip-hop, following the lead of Tipper Gore's Parents Music Resource Center from the previous decade. The hearings were led by a pair of female black elected officials from Illinois, Senator Carol Mosley Braun and Representative Curtis Collins, but accomplished little, and gangsta rap found a vocal ally in another black female U.S. representative, Maxine Waters, whose district included much of South Central. "These are our children, and they've invented a new art form to describe their pains, fears, and frustrations with us as adults," she said at one of the hearings. Other black leaders were not so sympathetic. Reverend Calvin O. Butts from Harlem's Abyssinian Baptist Church found wide support for his condemnations of negative rap. Outside of his church in June 1993, he fired up a steamroller but, at the last moment, declined to destroy boxes of CDs and tapes brought in for the purpose, saying he'd meet with the offending rappers instead. Apparently, he didn't have Snoop's number. "We could have sat down and solved this, like black men," he complained on the Arsenio Hall show. "He's a powerful leader, a preacher. He's supposed to school me. Don't patronize me, putting me in the media, crushing my CDs 'cause you making me money. You bought that CD, then you ran over it." Arsenio's audience applauded emphatically. Snoop and his crew maintained that they were describing inner city reality, shining a light on places the mainstream media tended to ignore. Further, their music allowed them to prosper legally, not to mention to employ others from their neighborhoods who might also get into trouble otherwise. "If I was a real gangster, I wouldn't be telling you what was going on. I'd just be doing it," Sticky Fingers of Onyx told MTV. But Snoop's trial undermined this message, and it became easy for the mainstream media to portray hip-hop as a place where lyrical violence and real-life violence were one and the same. These conversations could quickly get complicated. What with all the different socioeconomic, cultural, political, and historical threads, part of what made them difficult was that they often pitted two repressed groups against each other, women and African Americans. Even if you supported rappers reporting on inner city troubles, you might want them to do so without calling women bitches and hoes. But someone else who bristled at those words might not believe we needed to continue attacking the black men saying them. A central motivation for highlighting gangster rap continues to be the sensationalist drama of demonizing black youth culture in general, and the contributions of young black men in particular, wrote black feminist scholar Bell Hooks. In the end, gangster rap won. Though conservative commentators and politicians still trot out a hip-hop boogeyman every now and then, hardcore hip-hop has assimilated into our culture. Lyrics that sounded shocking in N.W.A.'s time, the derogatory terms for women, the violent taunts, are now the norm. Despite their long and documented histories of condoning lawlessness in various forms, rappers including Snoop, Ice Cube, Eminem, Jay-Z, and many others are highly paid corporate spokesmen for mainstream brands. There aren't even all that many serious music critics anymore who disavow hard-edged hip-hop, despite that it remains rife with violent, misogynist storylines. Ultimately, American society has more or less come to accept the music as legitimate protest art, or at least as legitimate entertainment. By the fall of 1995, facing attacks from all corners and on trial for his life, Snoop was spooked. "My heart was beating like I was smoking crack in the courtroom every day," he said. He even gave occasional signs now and then that, just maybe, his critics might have a point. "I probably will become more of a positive image," he told Arsenio Hall, "but that's way down the line." He was buoyed by reuniting with both of his parents. His mother Beverly, from whom Snoop had been estranged for years, stood by him during his trial, which began on November 27, 1995. Snoop's long-absent father, Vernal Varnado, a Detroit postal carrier, took early retirement and returned to L.A. to support his son. Snoop was also boosted when key evidence in police custody mysteriously disappeared. Celebrity attorney Johnny Cochran was brought on as well. He had recently helped clear O.J. Simpson in his own murder case and echoed that famous closing argument when referring to the missing evidence, critical shell casings and Woldemarium's bloody clothes. "If it doesn't fit," he told reporters, "you must acquit." Jurors agreed, and after 6 days of deliberation on February 20, 1996, Snoop and McKinley Lee were acquitted of murder charges. When the verdict was announced, Snoop's head dropped into his chest, and he put his hands together in prayer. To celebrate, Death Row splurged on 4 new Rolls Royces. Snoop would have other legal trouble. In August, he settled a civil suit filed by Woldemarium's family for an undisclosed amount. They had originally sought $25 million. Meanwhile, he quietly handled suits from musician David Ruffin Jr., who co-wrote Gin and Juice, and actor Michael Todd Jones, who alleged they were battered during the filming of 2 Snoop music videos. Shortly after his acquittal, Snoop married his longtime girlfriend, Shantae Taylor. The pair had begun dating in high school. Behind the scenes, the man who'd lived a wild, sometimes criminal lifestyle was changing his outlook. It put everything in the right perspective. As far as my life, as far as not wanting to bring no harm to nobody or betray myself like that anymore, he said. From that day on, I seen myself turning into a different person, creating myself into a man. Step Brothers. Despite fronting Snoop's considerable legal fees, Death Row not only survived during this time, but prospered, generating well over $100 million in sales from its first releases. But while his close associates were realizing their music industry dreams, Warren G was suffering in silence. Unlike Snoop and Nate Dogg, he was not offered a record deal by Death Row, and he sunk into despair. It doesn't make much sense. Considering Warren's talents, his ties to Snoop, and the fact that his stepbrother was the linchpin of a rap empire, he should have been in the thick of things. But he's barely on Doggy Style, and was underutilized on The Chronic as well. The only time you hear him is on the humorous intro to D's Nuts, a telephone conversation.
"Did what's-her-name done get at you yesterday?"
"Who?"
"D's Nuts."
Warren received no royalties from The Chronic, he said, and is not credited for his technical contributions to the work, although they were sizable. Mining blaxploitation soundtracks and other records, he said he brought Dre the samples used for Let Me Ride, Nothing But a G-Thang, Lil Ghetto Boy, Stranded on Death Row, and Rat-a-tat-tat. Though others have whispered that Dre didn't give his stepbrother his proper due, Warren himself doesn't complain.
"I do the little bitty shit, and then he take it and make that motherfucker big," he said.
When Warren G's father married Dre's mother, their families merged, and Warren worshipped his older stepbrothers Tyree and Andre. They romped at the park, helped with Verna's fashion shows, and took karate. Dre and Tyree were always thick as thieves, but Warren's relationship with the budding super-producer was more complicated. Dre sometimes generously supported his kid brother, sometimes kept him at arm's length. Dre has never embraced nepotism. Back in the 80s, when his younger cousin Sir Jinx begged him to check out his group, Stereo Crew, Dre at first resisted. Much later, 2 of Dre's children would attempt to break into the industry as rappers. Dre first met his eldest son, Curtis, when the latter was 20. A paternity test confirmed the relationship, and he rapped as both Curtis Young and Hood Surgeon. Dre's daughter, Latoya Young, meanwhile, has rapped under the name Minaj. She complained loudly that her father was not involved in her career in her 2008 self-made documentary, Daddy's Shadow, in which she tried unsuccessfully to confront him at his Sherman Oaks studio, and bemoaned that he hadn't signed her or funded a label of her own. The viewer is left feeling sympathy for both perspectives. Minaj is a strong rapper, but Dre's desire to see his daughter chart a more stable career path is understandable. When it came to Warren's musical aspirations, Dre was initially a fantastic coach. At their Compton home, he showed him DJ tricks like how to blend and how to switch back and forth between two turntables. He eventually taught Warren production techniques too, such as how to sample and how to incorporate live instruments into his tracks. When Warren requested help with the MPC 60 drum machine, Dre said he could have his drum machine. "He showed me everything," Warren said. In the spirit of Dre and DJ Quick, G-Funk producers who also rapped on their own tracks, Warren began rhyming and excelled at that too. It's not clear how strongly Dre advocated for Warren at Death Row. It may have been a lost cause, considering the long line of artists in front of him, and Suge Knight also may have been a fly in Warren's ointment. In his book Labyrinth, author Randall Sullivan writes that following a Source article in which Warren appeared to take credit for Death Row's success, a rumor went around the label that gun-bearing bloods visited him late at night and warned him to be more careful with his words. "Someone quoted me saying that I built Death Row," Warren said. "I didn't build it, but I definitely brought all my people there." Whatever the case, it quickly became clear that Death Row was not his home. He also didn't have a home, period, though Cold 187 sometimes let him crash at his place. He tried to keep his spirits up. "I said, I know I got dope music. I ain't gonna let nobody break me down and tell me my shit ain't dope," he said. It helped that his pal Nate Dogg kept pushing him. Warren began pursuing new channels, landing a production credit on MC Breed's 1993 song, Gotta Get Mine, featuring Tupac. He earned a four-figure cash payment, which got him a burgundy Regal. Even better, the track put him on Tupac's radar, who invited him to a studio session. Warren found him a sample for Definition of a Thug Nigga, which appeared on the Poetic Justice soundtrack released in June 1993. But they weren't finished that day. Before long, Tupac's collaborators from his group Thug Life showed up, informing him that a mutual friend named Kato had been murdered over little more than a set of expensive car wheel rims. Warren put on another beat, and Tupac quickly composed How Long Will They Mourn Me, which featured Nate Dogg and was released on Thug Life's 1994 debut. Warren and Nate Dogg also landed another Poetic Justice soundtrack song, Endo Smoke, headlined by West Covina rapper Mr. Grimm. Extolling the virtues of a marijuana haze, the mellow hit served as great publicity for Warren, whom Grimm shouts out by name. Endo Smoke got the attention of Def Jam label executives Lior Cohen and Chris Lighty, who hadn't even realized Warren's affiliation with Snoop or Dre. The pioneering New York label had largely missed out on the exploding L.A. scene and righted things by signing Warren. Regulate. By now, Warren had his own Long Beach apartment and set to work crafting tracks in a makeshift studio there, using the closet for vocals. He kept coming back to Michael McDonald's yacht rock era track, I Keep Forgetting, which his parents played when he was young. "I had the sample and was like, it would be so different to do a hip-hop song over this," he thought. And so, again enlisting his always-ready-for-action comrade, Nate Dogg, they went about replacing McDonald's smooth falsetto with back-and-forth verses, the way Dre and Snoop had done on Nothing But a G-Thang. The plot of Regulate, vividly detailed, involves a dice game gone bad, with gats-toting bad guys attempting to separate Warren from his wealth. But they have messed with the wrong East Side Long Beach denizen, and Nate Dogg quickly comes to his rescue. Following a shootout, the men retire to the East Side Motel with some ladies who, for some reason, just can't seem to get their car started. As for the song's title, we used to always say regulate. We need to regulate the crowd. We need to regulate them over there, Warren said. Then when I heard it in a movie, oh my God, I lost it. Said Flick was 1988 youthful studs in the Old West drama, Young Guns, and the quote in question came from ranch enforcer Charlie Baudry, played by Casey Shemoskoff. He advises would-be posse member Billy the Kid, played by Emilio Estevez. We regulate any stealing of his property. We're damn good, too. But you can't be any geek off the street. You gotta be handy with the steel, if you know what I mean. Earn your keep. Regulate was arguably G-Funk's biggest hit. You won't find many people born in the 70s or 80s who won't whistle along. There's really nothing like it. The song lacks a chorus, but Warren's crisp raps and Nate's buttery smooth verses obliterate the need for one. The biggest question surrounding the song was which label would get it. After an A&R representative played it for Jimmy Iovine, he insisted on it for the Death Row-produced Above the Rim soundtrack, citing Nate Dogg's involvement. But Def Jam wanted it for Warren's debut, and so a compromise was brokered, and the song appeared on both albums. Released in March 1994, Above the Rim, also boasting the Lady of Rage's signature anthem, Afro Puffs, became Death Row's fourth consecutive multi-platinum release. And even bigger seller was Warren G's album, Regulate, G-Funk Era, which followed 3 months later. The Warren says Suge wouldn't let Snoop appear on it. The album succeeded, going much deeper than Regulate. Particularly poignant is Do You See, co-written with Corrupt. It is an autobiographical tale of 213's ascent, and sympathetic to those driven to a life of crime. Now who's the real victim, can you answer that? The brother that's jacking or the fool getting jacked? The song's spoken intro. Why should the blues be so at home here? Well, America provided the atmosphere. Came courtesy of proto-rap poet Gil Scott-Heron, whose work Warren discovered by chance one day while digging through vinyl at Hollywood Shop as the record turns. He told me that he was also turned on by black activist collectives, Watts Prophets, and Last Poets, particularly the latter, whom he discovered after Dre sampled their tracks like Die Nigga on Niggas for Life. Regulate G-Funk Era sold over 3 million copies, and is credited with almost single-handedly propping up Def Jam at a time when its fortunes were flagging. All considering, Dre and Suge's resistance may have been just the thing for Warren to find the fire in his belly. As for the debate about who invented G-Funk, Warren argues that he deserves credit. I started it, he said in 2011, taking some gangster shit and putting a melody to it, and having a guy which was Nate Dogg sing some soulful gangster shit about how he felt. That was G-Funk. Smoke weed every day. Nate Dogg died in 2011, at the age of 41. His career was bigger than the sum of its parts. He never had a solo song or album in the top 10, but yet during his 20 years singing hooks on hard-edged hip-hop songs, he helped trace the genre's evolution. His self-assured, pitch-perfect choruses provided gangster rap's foundation. He would have prospered in any genre. Born decades earlier, he might have sang the soul blues or jazz. Countless rappers came and went, but Nate Dogg was always there. As Ice Cube put it on his group West Side Connection's 2003 track, Gangsta Nation, it must be a single with Nate Dogg singing on it. His influence was so vast, his voice such a critical part of the canon, it's hard now to remember a pre-Nate Dogg rap world. Before he put hip-hop's mentality to melody, R&B singers mostly did their own things, while rappers did theirs. Nate was different, Snoop said. He was the first R&B singer to say what all the R&B singers wanted to say. These things were, of course, largely about loose women and sticky herbs. But like Snoop, Nate started in the church, performing with his brother and sister in a gospel trio called the Hale Family Singers, which took them as far away as Mississippi. "My family don't listen to R&B. Never have, never will," he said in 2004. "They only listen to gospel. That's where I get my voice from." In high school, he moved in with his grandmother and got into secular singers like Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, and New Edition. His first self-penned track went, "Baby, darling, darling girl, I really love your jerry curl." He didn't have much formal training, but knew what sounded right. After all, as he told Vibe, he could sing before he could talk. Still, early producers and engineers often didn't know what to do with him exactly. His voice is too low in the mix on tracks like Lil' Ghetto Boy, Endo Smoke, and How Long Will They Mourn Me? But his talents rose to the surface, despite the fact that Nate wasn't much of an entertainment industry hustler. Wearing a thin goatee and a perpetually sleepy expression, he didn't bother with hobnobbing. Before autotune made everyone sound like they had chops, Nate did it naturally. He had a special voice, the way his voice layered on top of itself, and how he knew how to stay in pocket, said producer Mike Dean. He had a temper. Don't forget the golf course incident. And he also faced domestic violence and gun allegations. But Nate Dogg's legacy is great music. He stood next to bigger name MCs who got their tracks top billings, even if Nate's contributions won out. Would we still remember Ludacris's Area Codes without Nate's hilariously earnest chorus? "I've got hoes, I've got hoes, in different area codes, area codes." He elevates 50 Cent's otherwise cliche-packed 21 questions and saves Snoop's Ain't No Fun and Tupac's It's All About You from sounding too nasty. And with all due respect to Mos Def and Pharoah Monch, the ultimate takeaway from their 2000 song Oh No is Nate's part. "Oh no, look at who they let in the back door. From Long Beach to Brooklyn, they know. We rock from the east to the west coast." He wasn't a one-trick pony, though, demolishing tracks on his own as well. The song One More Day from Murder Was the Case, for example, maintains the weight of a spiritual. "If I live to see tomorrow," he sings, "thank you for one more day." But he never quite fit into the Death Row game plan, and his first solo album wasn't released until 1998. As a trio, 213 lost momentum, and their proper debut, The Hard Way, felt anticlimactic when it came out in 2004. Nate excelled as a gun for hire, the man you enlisted if you needed a surefire hit. When Dr. Dre finally figured out how to properly deploy him, he usually stole the show on tracks like The Next Episode, which features his signature line, "Smoke weed every day." Suffering strokes in 2007 and 2008, Nate lost the ability to talk, though he could blink and spell out messages using his eyes and an alphabet board. But music was always with him. Even as his health declined, he put together a choir called Innate Praise, which featured Jacob Lusk, a singer known from his American Idol appearances. He was getting into gospel music, and there wasn't going to be no more I Got Hoes, said Warren G. Chapter 19. The One by His Side. By his late 20s, Eazy-E had achieved his dreams. He'd created one of history's most successful independent music labels. In the early 90s, he maintained a coterie of talented artists, loving women, and adoring children. His girlfriend, Tracy Jernigan, drove a new Acura with the license plate, "Love for E." He indulged hobbies like skateboarding and built his collection of monster dolls. He amassed lowriders. At Christmas, he drove around in one while wearing a pom-pom Santa hat. At restaurants, he'd order one of everything, just because he could. He came and went as he pleased between his various houses and mansions, where his friends and artists lived in the extra rooms rent-free. His social circle stretched all over the L.A. metro area, from Cal State Northridge students to Old Compton friends. He'd even created a film company, planning to release a thriller he'd helped write and would star in called Smiling Faces. Most everyone who knew Easy remembers him fondly. "He treated us like princesses from the moment we met him," said J.J. Fads, MCJB. "He was like, do you need anything? Do you need any money?" As his success mushroomed, he became increasingly generous. His bodyguard, Joe Fierro, recalled Easy covering fancy dinners and medical bills for the birth of two of his children. His former crack-dealing partner, Mark Rucker, had gone on to get a straight job as a welder, but when they reunited, Easy insisted he quit and gave him a job with Ruthless. Easy bailed people out of jail and tipped waitresses lavishly. He gave to charity, too. He was particularly devoted to a mentoring and education organization called Athletes and Entertainers for Kids, not just writing checks, but helping plan their trips to amusement parks in painstaking detail, down to the goodie bags and the t-shirt design. "He was fully engaged. I cannot say enough about Eric as a human being," said Elise Kim, the organization's founder. His friend, Jada Pinkett, attended some of these events with him, sporting head-to-toe denim. Kim believes they were dating. "They were like college kids," she said. Charisse Henry, Easy's assistant, remembers Easy having a crush on Pinkett. "She was short, little, and light-skinned, and that's what he likes." And that she was an aspiring rapper with a demo tape who hoped unsuccessfully to sign to Ruthless. Pinkett did not respond to a request for comment. With his own children, by 1994 he had 9, Easy was usually generous, and with their mothers as well. "Christmases were ridiculous," said Henry, recalling how he would fill trucks with bikes, toys, and clothes for his kids. He was also involved in numerous child support cases. In 1993, he was ordered to pay $58,000 annually to the mother of his 2-year-old Nebraska-raised daughter in what a prosecutor called the largest child support order handled by the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office. Having shot ahead in his baby race with his friend, Mark Rucker, he now had a new goal. "He would say, 'I want a football team,'" said Charisse Henry. Jerry Heller helped handle Easy's child support payments and scheduled paternity tests. "He always had so many girls around him," said Rebecca Armstrong, a former Playboy playmate who appeared on the cover of Ruthless Act Penthouse Players Click's album, Paid the Cost. "It didn't seem he had any preference. All sorts of different colors, races." Armstrong said she resisted Easy's advances. From time to time, Easy found himself in legal hot water, usually for traffic incidents, reckless driving, driving with a suspended license, but sometimes for more serious charges. In 1993, he pleaded no contest to charges of battery and theft. The details are unclear. And as punishment, was ordered to make a fire safety public service video, which you can see on YouTube. Pacing in front of a fire engine as a rescue was dramatized, Easy preaches the importance of preparedness, warning, "Toys could be replaced. Your kids can't." Though Henry said she never saw him lose his cool, his knuckles were scarred from fights. Ruthless assistant general manager Gary Ballin said he saw Easy knock out a 300-pound man, cold, with one punch. Easy had a violent streak, which extended to women. Tracy Jernigan, whom Easy once shot in the head with a BB gun, demurred when I asked her directly whether he ever hit her. "We had a really volatile relationship," she said. "When you keep going through all this craziness, and two people can't stay away from each other, it's just some kind of strong love." Lisa Johnson, the mother of 3 of Dr. Dre's children, who said Easy beat her in Compton and sent her to the hospital before a planned trip to Magic Mountain, surprisingly didn't have much bad to say about the Ruthless Records founder. "He was a sweetheart," she concluded. Reaching new audiences. Easy's pagers and cell phones were always going off, and he never got much sleep. He ate out constantly, junk food usually, or maybe a plate of fettuccine Alfredo. It's impossible to imagine living in this world, one with seemingly everything you ever wanted, but also constant stress. As a young hustler, he didn't drink or smoke weed, because he wanted to stay sharp. But in the years following NWA's breakup, he gave himself over to these indulgences, shooting Jack Daniels and getting high constantly. He dropped big cash at strip clubs and hung out with porn stars. According to Jerry Heller's memoir, he encouraged his female group, HWA, Holes with Attitude, to Sharon Stone record executives, referencing the famous Basic Instinct, legs uncrossing scene. For all his largesse, Easy was unsettled. He had trouble on his mind. The Suge Knight menace wasn't going away, and he soon learned of another enemy, heavily armed Southern California white supremacists. In July 1993, the Los Angeles Times reported that the FBI was investigating a group of skinheads who wanted to start a race war and had amassed a giant cache of machine guns, sawed-off shotguns, and pipe bombs. Their purported targets included Rodney King, Al Sharpton, and Easy. Easy and some of the others were never warned they were in danger. He couldn't help but see this as further payback for fuck the police. "Again, the FBI has shown their true feelings," read a statement he released. The FBI contended Easy's safety was not endangered. But more than external threats, Easy was being eaten up from within. Since Cube and Dre left NWA and became even bigger stars, he'd had a chip on his shoulder. Henry believes this is why he began smoking weed after The Chronic came out. "I'm thinking he was trying to mask how he was feeling deserted and embarrassed." He was anxious to prove he could win without them. He sat on Arsenio Hall's and Howard Stern's couches and complained that Dr. Dre was a fraud, a studio gangster. Before he took up with Easy, Dre had been wearing biker shorts and wasn't even repping Compton, he went on, but the public didn't care. The Chronic was the bomb. Dre's music spoke for itself, and his youthful indiscretions, if that's what you want to call them, didn't change that. Easy's jealousy began affecting his business dealings. MC Ren complained that his recording budgets kept getting slashed, not because he wasn't selling, but because he wouldn't come out swinging against Dre. Another reason Ren may have gotten the short shrift was because Ruthless was on an insane hiring spree, looking for the next big act to make everyone forget Cube and Dre. Early on, Ruthless had signed very few artists and hit with nearly every release. Now Easy signed dozens of different acts. In 1994 alone, Ruthless released albums from 9 different artists, including little-remembered acts like Nashville rapper Pistol and female duo Menajahtwa, pronounced Menage a Trois. Easy didn't want Ruthless to be known for just gangsta rap. He toyed with the ideas of a sublabel dedicated to children's music, and even made a song himself with Guns N' Roses, though it never saw the light of day. Curiosity was one of his defining traits. Easy was fascinated by Judaism, for one. He'd stuck with Jerry Heller despite countless anti-Semitic insults, and at his nephew Terry Heller's grandfather's funeral, Easy wore a yarmulke. Tracy Jarnikin was Jewish, and said the faith was very prevalent in her relationship with Easy. He even signed a group called Blood of Abraham, a pair of early 20-something Jewish kids from the Valley. Though major labels expressed interest, Easy promised them freedom to express their political messages on songs like Niggas and Jews, Some Say Kikes. He said, "You guys are on a militant tip," said group member Binyad. "You can talk whatever shit you fucking want." Easy was also fond of Mexican-American culture, which he called the sleeping giant. Convinced Latino rap was the future, he signed Kid Frost, who'd come up in the electro scene and broke out with his 1990 Chicano Pride anthem, La Raza, from his album Hispanic Causing Panic. Easy bought him out of his Virgin contract. Kid Frost was already a legend. But Easy also befriended a South Central gangbanger named Gilbert Izquierdo, known as Toker. He and his friends weren't impressed with early Latino rappers, and as the group Brownside, made hardcore rhymes describing their real lives in their neighborhoods. They even self-financed with street money, following Easy's template. One 1994 afternoon, the whole crew arrived at the Ruthless offices. They were a dozen or more, rappers and neighborhood associates alike, with names like Danger and Trigger, and hairnets and Pendletons buttoned at the top. They rolled up in Chevy lowriders, hard tops, and convertibles, even a station wagon. Easy couldn't believe the fleet.
"Whose cars are those outside?"
Easy said, by way of hello.
"That's our shit," said Toker. "Those motherfuckers are nice," Easy continued. "You want to sell them?"
Toker declined, but let him hit the switches on his 61 Impala hardtop. He made it hop like a pro.
"Damn fool," Toker said.
They began chatting. Easy knew their neighborhood in South Central. He was involved with a woman from the 20s streets, he said, adding that she'd even talked up their affiliated gang, Eastside Trace. Nothing could have endeared him more to the crew, and meanwhile, Easy was impressed with their video for their song, Gang Related. He offered to sign them, but Toker eventually convinced him to give them a distribution deal. Brownside recorded their own version of The Boys in the Hood, called Vatos in the Barrio, and Easy and Toker became close. When Easy recorded his first safety PSA, Toker recorded a Spanish-language version. Easy liked Toker for his generosity, and because he helped him feel close to the streets. The Brownside crew, indeed, remained in the thick of things. Danger was later murdered, and not long after linking with Ruthless, Toker fought a murder charge himself. He was found guilty and agreed to be sent back to Mexico, where he hadn't lived since childhood. But his sentence was overturned on appeal, and he and Brownside today continue to make music in Los Angeles. Of all the new Ruthless acts, one was poised for a huge breakout. Bone Thugs and Harmony, a wholly original quintet that included a pair of brothers and a cousin, whose members came out of desperate circumstances. As he later explained on the show America's Most Wanted, Busy Bone was abducted as a child and worked at a dope house during his teen years. They exquisitely layered their parts and varied their tempos, switching back and forth between singing and lightning-fast rapping, a style learned because they spent so much time together that they all memorized each other's parts, creating an unprecedented new sound.
"It just started to sound like we were harmonizing," Crazy Bone told me, "and people started telling us, 'Y'all sound like the Rapping Temptations.'"
Originally called Bone Enterprise, and then just Bone, they came out to L.A. on something of a whim. Group member Flesh and Bone was attending school in the area, and convinced the others it was crawling with celebrities and opportunity. Longtime N.W.A. fans and intent on signing with Easy, they took a Greyhound to Los Angeles, where they began to call Ruthless, leaving persistent messages. Easy finally called them back, and Crazy Bone rapped for him over the phone. Easy said he'd be performing in Cleveland in a couple weeks, where Easy finally met them backstage.
"Were you the dudes rapping on the phone?"
he asked them, to which they responded affirmatively.
"I want to work with y'all," Easy went on. "When are you trying to leave?"
"Immediately," they responded. Bone Thugs single-handedly reinvigorated Ruthless Records. They gave Easy nostalgic pangs of himself and his group when they were younger. Crazy Bone said that when one of the group members got up to use the bathroom, the other four followed.
"Man, if N.W.A. would have been as tight as y'all, nobody would have never came between us," Easy told them.
As with Brownside, Easy felt he understood them because they came from the streets, but they were incredibly raw. Upon arriving in the Valley to record their 1994 debut EP, Creepin' on a Come Up, they partied their young brains out and were kicked out of countless hotels. The guys could spit fast and tell street stories, but Easy and their producer, DJ Unique, crafted them into something slower and darker, bordering on horrorcore. combining creepy voices and chanting with lyrics about dark spirituality and Ouija boards. Based on their early song, Thugs in Harmony, it was Easy's idea to add the Thugs in Harmony to their name. Their brash, madcap personalities were captured on the debut, which produced a huge single, Thuggish Ruggish Bone, and sold 4 million copies. Tamika and Jerry. Tamika Woods met Eazy-E at an L.A. club in 1990. She wasn't an adoring fan. In fact, he had to talk her into a date. "Just based off of image, I thought he would be kinda disrespectful," she said. But he impressed her with his manners and interesting conversation, and soon won her over. Like Eazy, she hadn't had much handed to her in life, reportedly shuttling between parents and living for a time in a foster home. She raised a child as a single mother, and, at a young age when she was broke, posed nude for a magazine. "I've had a Vanessa Williams experience," she said, but she worked to lift herself, attending a pair of L.A. community colleges, and in 1989 landed a job as secretary for Taboo Records' Clarence Avant, a music industry luminary who has worked closely with Quincy Jones and Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. Avant took over as Motown Records chairman in 1993, and Woods went with him. "She's beautiful, and she's ruthless, and she's bright," said Avant. Woods and Easy vacationed in Hawaii and had a baby boy together. Easy moved her first into his Woodland Hills house and then into a Topanga home not far from Calabasas. Short and light-skinned, wearing ponytails and toting Gucci purses, she was smart and serious, known to give as good as she got it. She laughed at him because he was afraid to open his sunroof on their first date. She wasn't his only woman, but perhaps owing to her music industry background, Wood seemed to have had his ear to an extent when it came to business matters. I could not reach Woods for comment for this book. "I was indirectly doing things for Eric at the company," she said. Easy's ghostwriter, Dirty Red, who was close to him in this period, downplayed Woods' influence. "Easy never told me and Tamika are thinking about doing this, or me and Tamika are thinking about doing that." Though he admitted, "I don't know what their deal was behind closed doors." Some speculate it was she who helped drive a wedge between Easy and Jerry Heller, whose relationship began to disintegrate in late 1994. The NWA biopic Straight Outta Compton, for which she is credited as a producer, alongside Dre and Cube and others, portrays her going through company books and looking for evidence of Jerry's malfeasance. "I think that toward the end of 1994, a lot of people were in Easy's ear. Jerry's doing this, and Jerry's doing that. He's charging you too much, and he's making more than you are," Heller said. Rapper Stefan said things were very awkward during this time, and that when Heller left the premises, Easy would scamper into his office and close the door. Jerry would be like, "What's up with your little buddy?" And I was like, "I don't know." Heller's role at Ruthless was more than just that of a traditional artist manager. He'd also been an investor in the company, putting up his own money to get it running. While Heller has never been found liable for any financial improprieties at Ruthless, some people who were close to the situation came to believe he was stealing, alleging there existed a bank account he shared with Easy, and he was excessively drawing from it. "What I was told from Easy, from his mouth, is that Jerry Heller put him $2 million into debt, and that's why he was done," said Dirty Red. BG Knockout recalled a time when Easy showed him company documents. "He had records from where money was missing from the label, millions of dollars that he said Jerry was stealing from him, and Jerry was sending him idle threats, faxes, and stuff like that." Crazy Bone also said Easy claimed Jerry was robbing him. Other insiders defend Heller. "He never told me Jerry was stealing from him. He always told me he knew where his money was," said Easy's assistant, Cherise Henry. "Jerry was always Easy-E's protector," Toker told me, adding that Easy nonetheless blamed Jerry in part for Cube's and Dre's departures. Heller insists he didn't steal a dime. "It's the most ridiculous allegation I've ever heard," he said. Around this time, Easy took on a new lawyer named Ron Sweeney, who was an acquaintance of Woods. Tracy Jernigan believes he and Woods worked to turn Easy against Jerry. Others point to the influence of Mike Klein, who'd been brought on to run security at Ruthless after Suge Knight's intimidations, and was later promoted to Director of Business Affairs. The way I saw it, Klein was wedging Jerry out of the picture, and Tamika was wedging Jerry out of the picture, Gary Ballin said. Sweeney did not respond to a request for comment, and multiple attempts to reach Klein for this book were unsuccessful. Whatever the case, in early 1995, after nearly 8 years of partnership, Easy and Heller parted ways. The latter said he received a letter ending their relationship that February, but doesn't believe Easy was in his right mind when he wrote it. A bad cough. One person in particular was happy to hear this news. Ice Cube. In late 1994, he and Easy, who'd already reconciled, ran into each other at the New York nightclub, The Tunnel. Easy was in town promoting Bone Thugs and Harmony, who appeared on Yo MTV Raps. It was a cold night, and though he just bought the group members' black leather jackets, he opted not to wear his own.
"We told him, man, you're gonna freeze to death out here. Plus his Jerry curl was wet," Crazy Bone said.
Cube arrived with upstart label owner Puff Daddy and his emergent artist Notorious B.I.G. That meeting would lead to the latter's collaboration with Bone Thugs called Notorious Thugs. Cube got a booth in the club, and Easy joined him. The conversation turned to reuniting N.W.A. Easy noted that Jerry was out of the picture.
"I told Easy I was down," Cube said. "He was in his feud with Dre at the time. I told him if he could work that out, call me."
A year earlier, Dre said, in an interview, that the group couldn't reunite unless it was on Death Row, which, considering Easy's animosity towards Suge, was never going to happen. But Dre said he and Easy spoke on the phone in early 1995 about maybe putting N.W.A. back together. It seems likely that their icy relations were beginning to thaw, to the benefit of a reunited N.W.A.
"It was definitely going to happen," Crazy Bone said.
He added that, though Easy still didn't acknowledge Dre's critical role in starting Ruthless, he was focused on fixing the damage he'd done between them, with the hope of getting the band back together. That night at the Tunnel, Easy and Cube spoke for hours. When the club closed, Easy was ill, prepared for the chilly New York weather. He couldn't catch a cab, so he simply walked off toward his hotel, shivering. Easy returned to Los Angeles with a bad cough. Easy was very sick. He didn't let on, but there were signs that he had begun to realize something was seriously wrong with him. In December 1994, after returning from New York, he recorded a track called "The Motherfuckin' Real," featuring MC Ren and produced by DJ Yella, in which he speaks on his fate and legacy.
"When I die, niggas bury me. Make sure my shit reads Easy motherfucking E. And it's a fact, to be exact, my tombstone should read, he put Compton on that map.
All I remember is him coughing a lot," MC Ren said, concerning the song's recording.
"I just thought he had a cold."
Easy started to act like someone whose days were numbered. He hurriedly signed on publicist Phyllis Pollock to help promote the yet unrealized N.W.A. project, and he got back in touch with Terry B., the white female rapper who'd released her debut on Ruthless in 1990. After seeing Ice-T perform with Body Count, Terry had felt the call of rock music and started a band called Manhole. But Easy wasn't with it, and her rock dreams remained in limbo, since she was still bound by the terms of her Ruthless deal. That is until early 1995, when Easy called her out of the blue, asking to meet up at the Del Amo Fashion Center in Torrance. He announced he was letting her out of her contract.
That day was life-changing for me. Because it allowed me to go on with my life, she said.
It was almost like Easy was attempting to make amends. One important relationship, however, had hit a snag. Tamika Woods. Easy threw her out of the Topanga house, said Vince Caruso, Ruthless's college radio promoter. Rapper Stefan was in the midst of this squabble, he said, talking with Easy there about Stefan's album Trippin' with No Luggage. They were going upstairs when they ran into Woods coming down.
Tamika's carrying her shit out, huffing and puffing. So I say, hey, Tamika. She don't say shit to me.
He say, never mind her, 'cause she leaving. One day in mid-February, Easy began coughing violently and experiencing chest pains. He thought it might be an asthma attack, although he wasn't known to be asthmatic. His hulking bodyguards, the twins, phoned Mike Klein, who told them to take Easy to the hospital. They brought him to Norwalk Community Hospital's emergency room, where doctors elected to keep him overnight. A test determined that he had bronchitis, and Easy was sent home. None of this seemed unreasonable.
Bronchitis runs in our family, said Easy's sister Patricia Wright.
Easy soon returned to the studio, where he was to record a verse for his song with BG Knockout and Dresta called DPG Killer. Easy hadn't yet recorded his part when he got to chatting with other people, thereby putting off an increasingly impatient BG. Eventually, he found Easy in a hallway,
by himself sitting on the floor wheezing, like terribly. And I was like, you all right?
BG said. He added that Easy was using some new, huge-ass inhalers in an attempt to control his breathing. Easy wasn't all right. He went to the Topanga house to recover. At some point, Woods returned. But so did his symptoms, as bad as before. And on February 24th, he was taken to Cedars-Sinai. Registered under an assumed name, he received a battery of tests, yielding a shocking result. Easy was HIV positive.
He was on the phone crying and couldn't talk. And then the doctor got on the phone and asked me, was I sitting down?
Woods said. She too cried her eyes out, but was forced to quickly compose herself. She would need to come in and be tested as well. Woods was scared, and not just for Easy and herself. She was pregnant again, with their second child. Chapter 20. Time to Testify. These were dark days for HIV/AIDS treatment, which was causing devastation at an increasingly alarming rate. The side effect heavy AZT was the only antiviral drug available in much of the world. Within days of his diagnosis, Easy's condition was downgraded to full-blown AIDS. Doctors gave him antibiotics to treat a lung infection, but his energy level quickly deteriorated. Woods monitored him around the clock, staying on a cot next to his bed. Word got out before long about his condition. His assistant, Cherise Henry, came as quickly as she could, as did the mothers of many of Easy's children.
Even the ones who used to fight each other, they were holding hands, crying, praying, Henry said.
Wearing long underwear and hospital gowns, Easy watched television and tried to keep his spirits up, whistling when Halle Berry came on the tube. But he could barely get out of bed and soon required an oxygen mask. His girlfriend, Carmen, braided his hair and put lotion on him. His mother brought him fresh fruit. His childhood friend, Big A, gave him a card signed by all the homies. But Henry had a sinking feeling, and not just about his health. She was concerned that he was speaking with Ron Sweeney about creating a will.
I don't trust your baby mama's lawyer doing your will, Henry told him.
As Easy's health faded, a power struggle commenced. Different parties positioned themselves as defenders of his interests, and it wasn't clear who was in charge. Heller still thought of himself as Easy's primary ally,
but could do nothing as Woods and Sweeney took over many of Easy's affairs. Ron Sweeney presented us with our first royalty checks, and we had never seen him a day in our life.